This is a CBC podcast. Cross Country Checkup is Canada's only national open line radio show. Join host Rex Murphy for discussions on national issues that matter to you. Find out more at cbc.ca/checkup.
That's how I roll.
From the Canadian
Broadcasting Corporation.
This is Spark.
This is Spark.
Technology.
Trends.
And fresh.
Fresh ideas.
Fresh ideas.
This
is on the air.
This is
online.
This is Spark.
cbc.ca/spark.
All right. I've got sticky notes marking the story about outboard brains on today's show, and I've updated my Google Calendar to list the interview about keeping secrets online, and I emailed myself the sound file on how to remember your passwords, and oh, I forgot to take the laundry out of the dryer. I'm Nora Young, and this time it's the Keeping Track of Stuff episode of Spark. When it comes to keeping track of stuff, sometimes we do that just by remembering things, you know, committing them to memory. But often we do that by recording them. Like you go to the beach and you take pictures so that in winter you'll look back and remember how much fun you had. Or you write down the list of groceries you need so that you don't end up scratching your head in the middle of the produce aisle. You could even go all the way back to the Incas, who kept accounts on complex knotted strings instead of memorizing. That's not new. But what is new is that now we don't even have to remember to write things down anymore.
I decided to take a photo of a cheese and it's labeled.
That's Esther Hargitay. She's a prof at Northwestern University who blogged recently about, well, why she took a photo of a cheese label.
I realized that I had a really hard time remembering which cheeses I liked, and when I finally found one that I really liked, I wanted to make sure that I would remember it the next time I went to the store. And it was interesting because the next time I went to the store, indeed, I forgot the name of the cheese, but I did have the picture with me in the camera's memory card, and I showed it to the cheese section staff at the supermarket, and she said, "Oh, this is wonderful. You don't know how many people come in and try to describe the cheese, but they can't remember the name, and I have no idea what to tell them. But you have the label, so I know exactly what you want."
It's an increasingly common thing. You could write something down, but why not just capture it on a portable camera or the camera on your phone?
I take all sorts of pictures. For example, if I'm in a bookstore and I find a book and I'm not ready to buy it, but I want to read up on it, I might take a picture of the book's title and author. If I'm out and about with my car and I park my car on a street in an area of town that I'm not that familiar with, then I might take a picture of the cross street signs just to remember where my car is. I don't have a GPS device in my car, so I still rely heavily on looking up maps online before I go somewhere. And I've realized that sometimes it's helpful just to take a snapshot of the screen instead of printing it out. I don't like too much paperwork around me. I think it's easy to lose.
A couple of weeks ago on the show, we talked about the idea of the outboard brain. You know, that we have so much stuff to remember now that we just store it on our cell phones, our computers, or online, and we call it up when we need it instead of memorizing it. But it turns out that doesn't solve our keeping track of things problem. It just shifts it. Hi, Saul.
Hi, Nora.
That's Saul Greenberg. He's a computer science prof at the University of Calgary who specializes in human-computer interaction.
Technology has changed the amount that we have to remember, but it's also changed what we have to remember. We have our phone numbers, our schedules, our contact information, the tasks we do, the conversations we're having through email and all the facts in it, and all those computer-related facts, the passwords we have to remember, the file and folder names, the locations of things, the PIN numbers, the URLs, the email addresses, and so on and so forth. So whereas before we had to remember facts, now we have to remember how we can find our facts. That is, where they are. How do we actually find our stuff? So some of this is, well, I know I have my stuff on my computer or on my PDA, but where is it? How do I navigate to it? What applications do I have to access to get to it? What buttons do I press? So that's one of the problems. Then there's all the housekeeping that goes on with it. How do I do my backup so I don't lose my memory? How do I transfer across my devices because I need it on more than one device? How do I organize my files and folders? How do I actually remember to carry my thing with me, my portable device? Because if we forget that, you know what happens there.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the fragility of all that, where, you know, paper and pencil is pretty robust, but with our devices, well, we can lose them or we can forget them somewhere. What happens if our system crashes? What happens if the internet goes down or our cell phone is no longer available?
You're actually giving me an anxiety attack now. My heart rate is elevated listening to this.
It gets worse.
It used to be that the limit on information you could keep around was physical. You could only have so many pieces of paper before you'd run out of places to sit. But with digital information, you can store it ad infinitum. So if the problem of keeping track has changed from how I remember to how do I find, how do people like Saul help us find?
Well, what we do is we try to design technology to first recognize what the problems are and to make it much easier. So, for example, we're all used to files and folders on our computing systems, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's, in some sense, our memory. But, you know, go to the average desk and what do you see? You see a pile of stuff. And those piles are things that help us remember at a glance what's going on in our lives. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there's been work on pile-based interfaces for technology for years.
Pile-based interfaces?
Yeah. So something that, you know, recognizes the piles and that we have that lets us essentially take our stuff and not force us to name things or to stick them in places, but to kind of scatter it around. I'm sure you've seen the computer screen where people have like 1,000 icons on their desktop.
That's my desktop. I've got 1,000 icons on it.
And that's actually a strategy that a lot of people use. They don't use any files or folders. But you get an incredible amount of clutter because we don't get the richness of cues that we have with paper and documents and other things that sit on our desks. But there's other things. I don't know if you know this, but when you go to a website, what do you think the chances are that you've been to that website in that particular page before?
Oh, I don't know. 1 in 20?
Nope. It's about 2/3.
What?
Yep. So on average, when we've done lots of studies on this in our own lab, at random, if a person visits a website, the chances are they've been there like about 2/3 of the time.
Wow.
So one of the questions is how do we get back to that page? And bookmarks, they're okay, but they're not that great. So one of the things we've been doing in our lab is to look at the record of what people have visited and try to predict what people are going to go to next based upon where they've gone before,
right,
and to show it to them. So at a glance, they can say, oh, yeah, that's where I'm likely to go.
Mm-hmm. Do you still know your friends' phone numbers and birthdays?
I never did, actually. No, I know my wife's and I struggle with my kids. It's a common joke in my house. My wife is the memory. I love her much more than I love my computer.
That's a good thing. Thank you so much, Saul.
Sure, Nora.
So assuming we get the right design for our devices, pile-based interfaces and all, what's the problem?
You could argue that it's making us stupider because if you can't remember things, then you're dumber. Like the way that, you know, most people can't remember phone numbers anymore because they just store them on their phone and then they forget about them.
We started thinking about this whole thing because a few weeks back when Clive Thompson was on the show, he was talking about this concept of the outboard brain, and he wondered whether it was making us stupid.
There's a cognitive argument that you lose a sort of mental discipline. If you stop remembering how to remember things, that's bad. There's a value in remembering a lot of data. But, you know, you could also look at it and say that, you know, this is, you know, we now have a world where I'm out at a bar and I'm arguing with friends and I've got Google on my phone. And Google has really a lot of information on it. And so we're arguing with something, and I'm you know, and this is what I do all the time. I'm, you know, Googling it while we're talking and learning stuff and incorporating it into what we're talking about. And so our conversation is just suddenly a whole lot smarter because we have these prosthetic brains out there that we get to use as we're arguing about this stuff. So in some senses, I think there's a real net positive there. And that blur between Google and my brain is going to get blurrier and blurrier.
So we've always looked things up in the encyclopedia or written things down to remember it. But is there a point where your outboard brain has so much info that it's actually making you stupid? I got in touch with Patrick Davidson to find out.
In general, if we want to learn information, learning information about a particular domain or learning a particular kind of information and becoming expert in it doesn't really make us general memory experts. So if I sit around at home memorizing trivia facts, this isn't necessarily going to make me better at committing people's cell phone numbers or email addresses to memory.
Well, that's good news. Patrick Davidson's a professor at the University of Alberta who specializes in the cognitive neuroscience of memory.
What we do know, though, is that the more we remember about a, or the more we learn about a specific domain, the easier it is to acquire new knowledge. So let's say I move to Canada, and as I learn how the country's organized and how the telephone system works, instead of calling somebody in Vancouver and having to remember to dial 1-604 and then the phone number every time, I organize this information into a sort of scaffold, and this helps me know that when I want to call Vancouver, it's 604.
Okay, so if I get this, I'm not going to get better at keeping track of stuff just by practicing keeping track of any old stuff. But if it's important to know, say, facts about memory, I can keep it straight by grouping it into piles or scaffolds. And how do I do that?
Things like visualization, making connections, using the method of loci, where you imagine if you have a list of unrelated items, relating them all together with a visual image, coming up with a rhyme, all that sort of stuff, does actually seem to work.
Hmm.
But at the end of the day, we often have so much information that's coming at us so quickly, and so it's no wonder if we're trying to do many things at once that we have trouble remembering our temporary password when we get to the bank machine tomorrow or remembering what we saw in the news.
Bottom line, if it's important to remember, pay attention. If not, delegate to your outboard brain and hope you don't leave your outboard brain behind you when you get off the bus.
From the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, this is Spark.
cbc.ca/spark.
Conversation reminds me that in a digital world, we have so many little bits of information that we have to keep track of. Remembering all your passwords alone is killer. Well, here's Dana Boyd with the answer to that problem.
Username:
Dana Boyd.
Occupation:
I'm a fellow at Harvard Berkman Center for Internet and Society.
Password: password: password.
Every single system asks you for a password, and at this point, many of them ask you for three or four different, you know, key questions.
Password. Password.
You know, I find myself very frustrated with, you know, password systems because they ask me to remember things that I often don't know the answer to, like what is my favorite sports team, and I'm sitting here going, I actually don't pay any attention to sports. I don't have a favorite sports team. And so one of the ways that I approach it is by putting it into sort of three different parts and answering all things with the same three different parts, where I have in the first section a sort of snarky bad attitude phrase. So say that that's like, you know, stupid question. And then in the middle, I sort of look at what the core noun was of the password question. So in this case, sports. And then I have a unique word that I use. So say like booyah. And so that my answer, you know, to that question would be stupid question, sports, booyah.
Name of your first grade teacher.
Stupid question, teacher, booyah.
Name of town where your parents were born.
Stupid question, town, booyah.
Name of your high school.
Stupid question, high school, booyah.
Name of your pet.
Stupid question, pet, booyah.
Access granted.
Booyah.
That was Dana Boyd from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society talking about a more personal aspect of her life than she did when she was on the show last time. Remember, she was the one who was talking about the case of the student who complained about the school administrator not declaring a snow day. Now, that story got us into a really lively yak at the blog. We wanted to know whether teachers who share their cell phone or their social networking information with students are more effective teachers. Lots of teachers weighed in.
I am teaching university for the first time and have given out email, Skype, and every other address. I have found it has been really valuable and effective way of adapting quickly to changes, giving information and communicating with 57 students I barely know for a one-term course. I would not be doing as good a job without it.
Teachers shouldn't expect to be on call 24/7. They respect this. We are in many ways taking a throwback to the old one-room schoolhouse where teachers had to sign a moral contract.
The return of the old schoolhouse teacher and the morals contract. Now, most members of the Spark community actually agreed with that last comment that came from Martin. Teachers love their jobs, but they don't want to be on call 24/7. Okay, back to keeping track of things. One of the great disappointments in life is sitting down at a bar, ordering a pint, and having the bartender slide you a beer with too much foam. Ugh. Now, if you're brave enough to send it back, that extra foam goes down the drain. In the bar business, they call this spillage.
Spillage is the stuff that ends up on the floor or ends up in collection buckets, broken bottles, extra foam on the top of your beer, spoiled wine, that kind of stuff.
That's Tom Lusher. He's a contributor to the show, but he also owns a bar in Windsor, Ontario called Fog Lounge. Now, once in a while, if you're a particularly good customer at a typical bar, you might get a drink, oink, oink, on the house. Often, that counts as spillage, too. But there's a new technology on the market that aims to reduce both spilled drinks and the occasional under-the-table drink on the house. It's called Brilliant. And basically, it's a computerized system that keeps track of every last milliliter of alcohol in a bar. Servers wear these wristbands with RFID tags to identify themselves, and they place their orders through a touchscreen. Then, an exact amount of alcohol is dispensed. Less spillage means fewer profits down the drain. So at a small venue like Tom Lusher's bar, spillage accounts for
about 10 to 15%. So it costs me, 10 to 15% is about average for any bar, really.
So Tom, what did you think when you first heard about Brilliant?
I thought about taxes. Mm. I thought about money saved and my not needing heart medication until I'm a very old man, because the real possibility of an audit scares most bartenders and most bar owners, I should say, because they know that there are drips and drops going down the drain that are supposed to go into government coffers. And in a 60 capacity venue like mine, I can save $500 a month or more.
Wow.
And every drop does count.
Right. Okay, so all that makes a lot of sense. And would you consider buying a tracking system like this for a Fog Lounge?
No. Probably
not. Why not?
The downsides are clearer than the benefits to me. With me, I think about the relationship with my staff. They would more than cock their heads at the idea of having every milliliter measured.
Right.
And I think they would take it very personally as a tattling device.
So who do you think might want to take advantage of this kind of thing?
Probably a bigger business, somebody who has a lot of faceless clientele. They're coming in on and off. You don't see them very often. And somebody who has a staff of 50 or more, a mega bar, people who have a very high turnover rate in terms of their employees. You know, trust is a major issue in any business. So if you have 50 employees coming and going every month, especially students, you probably want to keep track of every milliliter.
Mm-hmm. But the thing about spillage, Tom, is like you say, it's not just spilled beer or foamy beer. I mean, sometimes it's intentional. Like, what if I'm a good customer and I've been sitting at your bar all night giving you good tips and you want to pour me a double instead of a single? Brilliant wouldn't let you do that without your boss knowing that you were doing it, right?
No, it wouldn't let you do that. And pouring an extra ounce of wine is good business if someone's been, you know, doing this heavy tipping all night and smiling. And if I can't do something extra for that person on the other side of the bar that's really taking care of you and putting money in your back pocket, it kind of takes away from all of that interpersonal, that nice relationship that you get going if you are measuring every little bit. They're going to feel like they're being bartended by an accountant.
Mm.
And there's a reason people don't go out bar hopping to H&R Block and other financial services companies. It's because the nature of bartending is social. I do know the importance of putting a good drink in someone's hand and putting a smile on their face, even at the cost of, you know, an extra ounce of Shiraz.
Hmm. Thanks a lot for talking to us, Tom. But before I let you go, can I have a Gibson?
Oh, you know, I have a rule not to serve a drink unless the name of all the contents are in the name of the drink.
I'll just have a cup of coffee then.
All right.
From the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation.
This is Spark.
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 On the last episode of Spark, we played a game of speed cabling, where you and a challenger try to untangle a rat's nest of Ethernet computer cables. And even though it was a lot of fun,
yellow, yellow,
I have to say that when we offer people a chance to win a cabling prize pack, i.e. 94 feet of used up old Ethernet cables, I actually didn't really think we'd have very many takers. But we had lots of entries, and the winner of the speed cabling kit is Neil Pittman, who said he'd play it with a software development team at their annual barbecue. Thanks to everyone who played. Okay, on to this week's contest. We're preparing an item for the show on the popularity of how-to videos online. There are whole websites out there that are nothing but kind of YouTube for how-to videos. So here's the question we'd like you to respond to at the blog. What how-to video do you need in your life? For instance, Liz?
I need a how-to video to show me how to make rice. Mine's always sticky.
Visit us at the blog cbc.ca/spark and leave a comment about the how-to video you need for a chance to win a fashionable Spark reusable grocery bag. Okay, back to this whole idea of keeping track of stuff. It's one thing to keep track of your own stuff, but what about stuff keeping track of you? Between all the personal info you fill out when you sign up for online services, the reports of what you're doing that you volunteer about yourself at Facebook, and your GPS-enabled cell phone that knows where you are when you're holding it, there are an awful lot of ways of keeping track of where we are and what we're doing. So what, you might say? I've got nothing to hide. I'm an honest person.
I mean, according to some psychologists, we lie somewhere between 6 to 200 times a day.
Wow.
And those may be anything from the kind of veneer of politeness that means that the answer to how are you is fine, even if the real truth is subsequently less than that.
This woman with that amazing statistic is Genevieve Bell.
Genevieve Bell.
She's a cultural anthropologist, and she's the director of user experience for Intel. One of the things she's interested in looking at are the secrets and lies we tell in the digital world.
Creating alternate personas for ourselves, misleading other people on the web about our race, gender, age, occupation, the full sort of run the gamut there.
And all that lying and concealing means we're playing a game of cat and mouse between technology that wants to keep track of us and our own desire to avoid detection. So you lied to Flickr. What did you lie about?
I didn't actually lie to Flickr per se. I lied to Yahoo and I lied to them about my date of birth because I just didn't think it was any of their business. And unfortunately, I caught myself out because I then locked myself out of Flickr and needed to log back onto Yahoo and couldn't remember my password and needed to produce my date of birth and couldn't remember what I had lied about.
A tangled web we weave. You know, I find with myself, Genevieve, when I go to websites that ask questions about my identity or if I go to Facebook, say, where I'm supposed to say what I'm doing right now, it seems to sort of bring out this urge in me to lie or to kind of rig the system or something. Do you have any sort of sense of what that is that makes me want to do that?
Oh, I don't think you're alone. I mean, there's definitely been some recent work coming out of Israel in particular, with some psychologists there looking at the ways in which what normally would have kept you in check from doing that, the kind of shame, guilt, despair factor, is utterly absent in our online lying practices. And in fact, there's even some evidence to suggest that we lie online with glee. It fills us with a kind of enthusiasm that we wouldn't otherwise see. So there's definitely some interesting stuff going on there.
Right. You've used a term of a colleague, which is the arms race of digital deception. Can you explain what that means?
Absolutely. That comes from James Katz at Rutgers University, who's done some wonderful work over the last 10 years looking at mobile phones and the kind of social encounters we wrap around them. And more recently, he's interested in thinking about the ways in which people were using cellular technology to lie about where they were. I mean, how many times have we sat in the parking lot at work and told our spouses that we were just on the way home when really we weren't? It's, you know, that kind of stuff where mobile phones allowed us in some ways to mislead faintly about our locations. Of course, the retaliation, I think as James would put it there, was that people started to buy subscriptions to services that let you triangulate where the cell phone was in its cell site so that you would know its precise location. So one could no longer say one was, you know, in the parking lot if one was in the office because one's cell phone could actually reveal that. And I think he's been interested in the kind of upping of the ante that's going on in that space. So the kind of alibi services that are now available both in the United States and elsewhere in the world where you can effectively buy everything from background noise in a voicemail that suggests that you're at a conference rather than at a pub. Mm-hmm. So there's been a kind of ratcheting up there of both the ways technology in some ways can't help but tell the truth and the way that people want to continue to use it in a world that's a little more complicated than one of straight black and white truth telling.
Mm-hmm.
Cell phones know where they are, and there are services that can start to, you know, sort of take advantage of that knowledge. So there's a way in which not only the recording of everything, but the kind of geographic and contextual knowledge that the devices in our lives may have and mm-hmm. their complete willingness to blurt it out all the time. There's nothing to stop them. The devices don't know that, you know, in fact, we exist in a world where there's all kinds of social lies. Those small moments when one says, I'm fine, when the question is, how are you, is a way of keeping a conversation moving along and making sure that everyone feels okay. It would be something completely different if one were asked that and one's cell phone announced, well, she's running a temperature. She's been on the phone with her boyfriend for 2 hours and she's been in tears for the last 10 minutes. Would not be something you'd want your cell phone to tell someone else, but it mm-hmm. certainly is getting to a point where the technology embedded in those devices could announce those things.
So do you think in that sort of cat and mouse game between our devices keeping track of us and us wanting to maintain a certain distance, who's winning?
Well, ultimately, we can turn the devices off.
Right.
You know, gasp. One increasingly sees all sorts of practices around that. So mm-hmm. I think as long as there's an off switch,
yeah,
we have a capacity to preserve what is in fact a fairly fragile balance between the cultural ideals of truth-telling and the cultural practices of lying.
Genevieve, you confess that you had a hard time keeping track of your birthday lie to Yahoo, and I imagine a lot of people have that problem. Have you found an answer?
You'd think the answer would be just telling the truth. Now I write it down.
That's great. Thank you so much for talking to us.
You're welcome, Nora. Bye.
Bye. Well, that's it for our Keeping Track of Stuff episode of Spark. It's really an ongoing tussle, isn't it, between our desire to gather information on the one hand and our need to forget and sometimes conceal on the other. And I can't help but wonder if in that little cat and mouse game, the technologies that keep track might be getting the upper hand on the humans that rely on them. Spark was made by Dan Meisner, Elizabeth Bowie, Renal Gonsalves, and me, Nora Young. And by
Tom Lusher,
Genevieve Bell,
Dana Boyd,
Esther Hargitay,
Clive Thompson,
Patrick Davidson,
Saul Greenberg,
Lloyd Alter,
and
Martin Scherer.
Spark is made with Creative Commons music. Find the artists at the blog cbc.ca/spark. And that's also where you can find full interviews, our weekly contest. You can listen to the whole show and you can participate in the Spark community. We've got a great chat going on now about fonts in preparation for the Word Show, for instance. Come on, visit us and jump right in cbc.ca/spark. I'm Nora Young, keeping track of technology for you.
Oh, real asta.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.